Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and go to Cairo, Egypt, to speak with Hussein Shabka, Professor of Sociology at American University in Cairo. He has been observing the historic presidential elections underway and will discuss his findings, which indicate that an aggressive effort by Saudi Arabia to buy the vote may have backfired with Egyptian voters after enormous amounts of money in support of Islamic fundamentalists had poured in from the Gulf. Then we'll look into successful efforts by a bipartisan group of congressmen led by John Conyers and Ron Paul to insert language into the National Defense Authorization Act to undeclare war with Iran. Kate Gould, the Legislative Associate for Middle East Policy with the Quaker Lobby, the Friends Committee on National Legislation, joins us to discuss this significant step to slow the momentum in Congress towards war with Iran. Then finally, we'll be joined by Flint Leverett, who was the Senior Director for Middle East Affairs at the National Security Council from 1992 to 2003. We will look into the just-concluded P5+1 talks with Iran that yielded no breakthrough and ended with significant differences remaining, which presumably will be dealt with in Moscow in the next round of talks starting on June the 18th. And joining us now from Cairo, Egypt, is Hussein Shabka, who's a professor of sociology at American University in Cairo. And as a sociologist, Hussein Shabka, I take it that you did your own field work today on the second day of the Egyptian presidential elections.
Right, yes, yeah.
And what did you observe?
It went surprisingly well, very well organized, surprisingly small number of violations. Despite the great deal of excitement, everybody's excited because they're voting for the first time in their lives in a free election, so they are excited. But nevertheless, it was muted in terms of not disrupting the process.
But I understand there's been some acrimony between the former head of the Arab League, Aram Musa, and Mr. Shafiq. They've been trading charges, accusing each other of sinister rumors, and that they broke the agreement not to go on the media during the election days. Have you been following this?
Yes, but that's par for the course. I mean, they all broke the rules. Everybody broke the rules. But there was nothing really serious. And it's understandable that they would attack each other and try to do whatever they can to undermine their vote. But there was nothing serious.
So it was just a continuation of the election campaign, right?
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah.
So most of the analysis that we hear is basically that this will be a competition between people from the former regime in the form of Ahmed Shafiq, the former Air Force general, and a colleague of Mubarak's, and Ahmed Musa, the former foreign minister of Egypt, and the two candidates from the Muslim Brotherhood. That's the reporting we get.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And that's the way it looks to you?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, yeah.
So what about Hamdin Shabati,
the socialist? I think he's going to do better than expected. He's nowhere near as high. I don't think he's going to be anywhere near as high as the main contenders, but he's going to do better than expected.
And he is the only kind of secular, the one that would arguably be representing the original Tahrir Square revolution, right? My understanding is that the people that brought about the revolution feel that they've basically lost control of the politics.
Well, they have. They certainly have. Because the revolution's strength was that it had no leaders, but that was also its main weakness.
And clearly the military have been pulling the strings all along and ever since.
Yes, and they're likely to continue to pull the strings for the foreseeable future. Even if you get the perfect candidate tomorrow, it's not easy to end 60 years of military dictatorship overnight.
So the support that apparently the Air Force General Ahmed Shafiq is getting, I hear that that's based upon a desire amongst the Egyptian people, or at least a substantial segment of the Egyptian people, for stability.
And, absolutely. That is his biggest pulling point.
Right, but isn't there also a real possibility that the instability is being caused by the military? Because under Mubarak, there were thousands and thousands of thugs on the payrolls to enforce the dictatorship.
Yes, they certainly were. But I don't think the military is interested in instability. I think they know that the Egyptians generally, from pharaonic times, value stability beyond anything else. They are terrified of chaos. And that is one of the things that has continued to be a feature of the Egyptians since pharaonic times. And that is, I think, something that the military has realized, and I think the military wants stability.
So, again, let me remind the audience, I'm speaking with Hussein Shabka, who's a professor of sociology at the American University in Cairo, and he has been observing the vote today and yesterday for the presidential elections in Egypt, which, of course, followed the parliamentary elections, where the Muslim Brotherhood, along with the Salafist, more fundamentalist parties, dominate the legislature. Is there a possibility that we're seeing a kind of pragmatism and maturity in the Egyptian voters, in the sense that here in the United States, quite often, American voters give the Congress to one party and the presidency to the other? You think that's going to happen?
I don't think it's that sophisticated. I think it's more than anything, fear of chaos. And I think one of the advantages of what has happened, even though it was wrong at the time, was the fact that they had the parliamentary elections and the Islamic faction has won most of the seats, because that meant that people now see what they're like. I have met a surprising number of people from very limited incomes who have actually voted for the Islamic faction in the parliamentary elections and who said that they wouldn't vote for them again.
And is that because they promised not to participate in the presidential elections and reneged on that promise?
It's one of the many promises that they reneged on. Their Muslim brothers, in terms of the popular support, their main point of interest is all the money they have. They have endless amounts of money from the Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and the oil countries. And that's what gives them the strength. Without this money, they wouldn't be anywhere near where they are now.
So you could make the case then, Hussein Shabka, professor of sociology at American University in Cairo, you could make the case that Saudi Arabia is interfering in the Egyptian elections.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yes. They always did.
Right.
But
they really want a kind of theocratic government. Is that what you're telling us?
They want a government that will do their bidding, and they don't want a progressive government because that would be a threat to them.
And in terms of the candidates that are running for president, is there anybody that fits the Saudi Arabian model?
I don't think they would be unhappy with either Ahmed Shafiq or Amr Moussa, because I think they realize that neither one of them would be a threat to them.
But what about the two Muslim Brotherhood candidates, Fattoush and Morsi?
It's a love-hate relationship between them. They support them, but they fear them.
Because they're too liberal in their Islamic practices?
Yes.
And too tolerant?
And they disapprove of a lot of things that are going on in Saudi Arabia.
In terms of...
They disapprove of monarchy, for example.
I see. And what about Wahhabism?
These are the Salafis. These are the people who appeared suddenly out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
Before the revolution, they declared that it would be a sin to participate in the revolution.
And then,
they appeared suddenly because they have so much money.
Right.
So they are really their main supporters. They are the closest to the Saudi ideology, Wahhabi ideology.
And then on the other side, on the liberal secular side, they're obviously the people that started the revolution. They feel betrayed, right?
Oh, yes. The whole atmosphere in the revolution, when I went down the first couple of days, the people who were in Tahrir Square were very, very different from the people who went to Tahrir Square after the first two or three days. It was mainly young, educated, secular people. Some of them actually came from religious backgrounds, but they were not there for religious reasons. They were there for secular reasons, and the chants were for Egypt, not for any particular party.
So what has happened since is that the military, under its Supreme Council, that has been the ruling body since the revolution, they have clearly controlled the situation, controlled who got to run for the presidency, for example, found ways to marginalize the secular, educated and young. And the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces has, of course, promised a fair vote. You say today, I believe 50 million people are eligible to vote. I don't know how many did vote. Any sense of what the turnout was?
No, but I suspect it's going to be high.
But isn't there something fundamentally wrong here that you're voting for both a parliament and a presidency before there's a constitution?
Absolutely, yes. But that was one of the mistakes that the military did because of their lack of experience. I don't think there were any ulterior motives other than simple lack of experience and the fact that the Muslim Brothers wanted the parliamentary elections as soon as they possibly could because they thought they would be able to win a lot of seats. So you had these two factors, and that's what caused the unusual situation that we're in.
So is the military going to go back to their barracks? My understanding is that they have a pervasive influence over the Egyptian economy.
Oh, they do.
And there's lots and lots of businesses that they control. What's your sense of what the day after is going to look like? Whether, I imagine, if they get their candidate, either Al-Musa or Shafiq, nothing is going to change, right? Now, would it be fair to say that the only possible challenge to this continued military rule, whether it's overt or covert, would be the Muslim Brotherhood candidates?
Yes.
And what's the likelihood? Obviously, the vote's just taken place. There's no way to know which side won, whether the former regime won or the two moderate Islamists that were allowed to run.
I think the only thing that is more or less certain is that there's going to be a rerun.
A runoff.
Nobody's
right.
going to win an outright majority, and they'll have to have a rerun.
Right, a runoff. And that's supposed to take place, is it the 17th or the...
Yeah, 17th of June, yeah.
That's quite soon, so...
Yeah, yeah.
So we'll know in a day or so, I take by Friday, who's going to be in the runoff.
Yeah, we will.
I see. But what's your overall sense that either way, what? Either way, the military are going to win? Is that...
Oh, I think so.
It's that...
Oh, I think so. I think you cannot simply erase the influence of the military on Egypt, and I don't think it would be desirable to do that anyway. It would be too much of a shock for society. I think the harm that was done in Egypt by the 1952 coup that started the military dictatorship cannot be undone in months or years. It's going to take many years.
But haven't the Egyptian military, I remember at Tahrir Square, they were the heroes, but I take it that a lot of the luster has come off and that they're not quite held in such high esteem.
Yes, yeah, that's true. The military, the only reason the military did not fire on people in Tahrir Square and came out in support of the people rather than Mubarak was that they simply didn't want his son.
So,
that was their main problem.
I see. So it was just that the Mubarak family were just too greedy.
Yeah, they were far too greedy, and the son was far too arrogant. He's absolutely loaded.
And what do you think of the possible presidency of Ahmed Shafiq? I mean, it's odd that he's a Air Force general and a former fighter pilot, and he was very close to Mubarak, wasn't he?
He was, yes, but... he was not corrupt. There's been nothing to show any kind of corruption at all. And if there had been anything, it would have come out. He was a good manager. He ran the Ministry of Aviation well. And so he's got a good reputation from that point of view. If he hadn't made the mistake of accepting to head the government in the last few days under Mubarak, he'd have been in a much, much better position. That's the main thing that people have against him.
But that was largely because of Mubarak's desperation, wasn't it?
He was trying to
find somebody that could put on a good face.
Yeah.
And accusations that he made money out of land deals in airports that were built under his ministry.
No, that's baseless.
They were kickbacks.
Nobody's been able to prove anything.
Right. I think, if anything, they were probably kickbacks to the Mubarak family.
But yeah, I mean, they were unbelievably corrupt.
Right, right. So what's your general feeling then on this day, this historic day? Do you feel that something historic has happened here?
Yes, I do. I feel optimistic.
And in spite of the extent to which the military's hand is still there, you feel that this is an important step forward?
Yes, it is. The military are not interested in staying in power. They want to stay in the background, but they're not interested in staying in power.
But they still want their privileges.
Yes, absolutely.
And you,
there's no doubt about that, yes.
And you can live with that.
One has to be realistic.
Mm-hmm.
They've been there for 60 years, and you can't just wipe them out in 2 minutes.
And you have no fears, given the amount of money that the Saudis and the Gulf are pouring in there to turn Egypt into a theocracy. You don't think that the Saudis are going to be successful?
No, I think whatever gains they made, the nature of the Egyptian people is far too moderate in the long term for the Wahhabi, for them to accept the Wahhabi ideology. They'll make gains in the short term, but in the long term, no.
And just in closing, you think that what happened in the parliamentary elections and this surprise appearance of the Salafists, that's had a backlash, that the Egyptian people...
It has. I have been very surprised at the number of lower-income people that I talk to, and I ask everybody I meet, who are you going to vote for, and who do you like, and who do you dislike. And I had been very, very surprised at the number of people who criticized the Muslim Brothers for their performance in the parliament, and the number of those people who said that they would never vote for them again.
And the,
obviously, it's not a scientific poll. I did not do research. It was just personal observance.
Sure. But these were poor and working-class people who would normally vote for the Brotherhood.
Who have voted for the Brotherhood and for the parliamentary elections.
But not again.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting, and I really appreciate you joining us here to give us a flavor of what happened today. And I thank you for joining us, Hussein Shabka.
You're welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Hussein Shabka, who's a professor of sociology at the American University in Cairo. He has been traveling around for the last 2 days observing the Egyptian elections firsthand, and he gave us a very interesting report. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the undeclaration of war with Iran. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Kate Gould, the Legislative Associate for Middle East Policy for the Friends Committee on National Legislation, a Quaker lobby in the public interest, fielding the largest team of registered peace lobbyists in Washington, D.C. She lobbies on Iran and Israel-Palestinian peace and has a piece at Common Dreams, Congress Undeclares War with Iran. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kate Gould.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
And explain to me the undeclaration of war.
Yes. Well, we actually have all of Congress, both the House and the Senate, on record declaring that they have not authorized the use of military force against Iran in the latest round of legislation. So this legislation has far-reaching impact for the U.S.-Iranian relations, very negative impact, I would say, but it is extremely important that Congress has clarified that they have not authorized war. They have not authorized the use of military force, showing that there are limits to the bluster in Congress.
And the House undeclared war, and of course the amendment was put in into the National Defense Authorization Act by Representative John Conyers, Representative Ron Paul, I should say, the presidential candidate as well, Representative Keith Ellison and Representative Walter Jones. That's a bipartisan group who put this amendment in, and it was voted on the eve of the P5+1 talks with Iran in Baghdad, which happened yesterday.
That's right. No doubt it had a very positive effect that in cooling the political climate for the negotiations to take place. So it's a very significant move.
But in your article at commondreams.org, Kate Gould, you say that the undeclaration of war with Iran is a remarkably sober note of caution and common sense in an otherwise dangerous and reckless piece of legislation. So tell us about what's in the National Defense Authorization Act.
Yes. Well, unfortunately, in the National Defense Authorization Act, otherwise known as the NDAA, there are billions of dollars for weapons to be used against Iran, specifically designed for a possible attack on Iran, and also money for warships and allocating funds for mounting gunships. Machine guns on, you know, boats in the Persian Gulf. There is just a wide array of weaponry that will obviously escalate tensions with Iran. So it is a very dangerous piece of legislation, very dangerous version that the House passed. And we hope as it goes forward in the Senate that those provisions will not make it through. And then in the eventual bill that the president signs, that those will be completely erased and that the only thing left will be that clarification that this legislation does not authorize the use of force against Iran.
Well, what's notable, though, about the National Defense Authorization Act is that it exceeds the limitations on Pentagon spending, which were agreed to in the so-called sequester, the Budget Control Act. And now the House Republicans are reneging on that agreement, and they've added $8 billion more, much of which is what you just told us about, right? This weaponry
exactly.
To be used against Iran.
Exactly, yes, including funds for a missile defense shield on the East Coast, which is quite a joke. The military, of course, has opposed it. Many military leaders in uniform have spoken out against this crazy use of money and saying that, you know, this is ridiculous to have a missile defense shield to supposedly protect against Iran's, you know, non-existent nuclear weapons. So, yes, it does go $8 billion over what is in law, what Congress passed, the Budget Control Act, on setting limitations on Pentagon spending. And then it also, one should note that the Obama administration's request also went over the Budget Control Act. However, this legislation goes $4 billion beyond what the president requested, which was already over what the Budget Control Act would allow for Pentagon spending.
But my understanding is that the Republican House, they want to balance the budget and they don't want to cut anything. They don't want any of these automatic cuts to affect Pentagon spending. Rather, they are talking about offsetting the cuts in food stamps and other programs.
Right. Yes, very unfortunate. And that's another key area of our work, is trying to ensure that those cuts are maintained, that we are working to preserve existing law. So,
Again, I'm speaking with Kate Gould, the Legislative Associate for Middle East Policy for the Friends Committee on National Legislation, a Quaker lobby in the public interest, fielding the largest team of registered peace lobbyists in Washington, D.C., where she lobbies on Iran, Israel-Palestine peace, and she also has a piece at Common Dreams, Congress Undeclares War with Iran. So going over to the Senate side, the legislation, I mean, I take it the House passed these amendments because they were getting all that they wanted on the hawkish side. It's hard to understand why they voted for it. Do you have any insight? I mean, this is not this is a pretty hawkish Congress.
It's a very hawkish Congress. Why they voted for, I mean, I think they were getting a lot of pushback. They were getting a lot of pushback that this was a bill for war with Iran. And so they wanted, they finally had to respond because of the public outcry. There were thousands of phone calls to Congress and over the past week, tens of thousands of messages saying that this was outrageous and you know, a host of different ways, one of which is that it requires the administration to develop a blueprint for an attack on Iran. It requires the administration to dramatically escalate the military presence in the Middle East and, you know, particularly the Persian Gulf, along with these billions of dollars for weapons that can be used against Iran. So they were getting a lot of pushback on that, and it worked. I think, you know, because of Representative Conyers' efforts and then getting that bipartisan group and getting a real grassroots movement mobilized around this push was
well. Do you think that Ron Paul's being a part of the one of the authors of the amendment, did he bring along his considerable number of people that to lobby?
Well, you know, I think that Ron Paul is well known as charting his own course and being, you know, independent from the party. So I think, however, we do know that there was agreement from the ranking member of the Armed Services Committee, Adam Smith, in pushing this forward. So while he didn't actually co-sponsor it, he did support it, and that is huge. And then we also know that the chair of the Armed Services Committee, Buck McKeon, that he actually decided to go along with it. He decided to let this pass because it should be mentioned that this, rather than go onto the floor for an individual vote, this was actually passed in what's called en bloc, you know, amendments. So it's passed in a package of other amendments that are seen as wholly uncontroversial. So it is remarkable that even the hawks on this issue, they felt so much pressure from their colleagues and so much pressure from members of from the grassroots that they saw that this was something that they had to allow. Unfortunately, you know, we would have liked to see the actual language, this pro-war language and this pro-war money, be removed from the bill. And while we didn't see that in this round, we hope that we will in the Senate and have good reason to believe we will. But we did have this very important clarification, and I think that's really a testament to the fact that the grassroots advocacy push on this did work, was successful, and it also helped, I should say, that the administration specifically complained about this pro-war language in their statement of administration policy when they had said that they were considering, you know, vetoing the legislation if it specifically because it was too expensive. It went, you know, far beyond the Budget Control Act and beyond what the Pentagon had been requesting. That they specifically singled out this language as undermining the powers that the president has to conduct foreign policy and be commander in chief.
Again, Kate Gould is the Legislative Associate for the Middle East Policy for the Friends Committee on National Legislation, a Quaker lobby in the public interest, fielding the largest team of registered peace lobbyists in Washington, D.C. And she has an article at Common Dreams, Congress Undeclares War with Iran. So let's move across to the Senate now. And while the House unanimously passed Representative Conyers' amendment, that of course was joined by Representative Ron Paul, Keith Ellison, and Walter Jones, a bipartisan amendment, in the House, Rand Paul offered a similar amendment, but Senators Lindsey Graham and Joe Lieberman blasted it, right? And insisted it be taken out.
Exactly. So Senator Paul offered an amendment that said that the sanctions legislation was not an authorization for the use of force against Iran or Syria. He added that he actually had blocked the sanctions bill from going forward many weeks earlier. I think actually last time I spoke with you, he blocked it from going forward, saying that unless there is this language included, that he would continue to place a hold on that legislation. But that legislation did get, that language did get incorporated, that it is not an authorization for the use of force against Iran. Senator Lieberman and Senator Graham really, they blasted that decision. They said that it was a very imprudent move, that it would send the wrong signal to Iran, when actually the signals that they have been sending to Iran through their legislation lowering the threshold for war, they have their own resolution on that, that actually sends the signal to Iran that that negotiations, you know, is not possible, and tries to back Iran into a corner. A corner that none of us want to see Iran backed into. So it was a very interesting debate, and it showed that there is a lot of resistance in Congress to even that, what seems to most people to be a very innocuous piece of legislation. And I think that shows how powerful it is. That shows exactly why it's so important to have that language in there, to when you see that others having complaints because it sends the wrong signal, when actually it sends the right signal. So Senator Paul did get his language in there, and also there was a compromise reached so that there would be another paragraph laying out different ways that the U.S. can prevent a nuclear weapons-capable Iran, and mentioning that military option has to be on the table. They echo President Obama in making that kind of statement. So they did highlight the military option. That's what they got out of this deal. But what in that context, though, I mean, the Senator Paul language that it does not authorize the use of force is really remarkable. It really I think eclipses what Senator Graham and Senator Lieberman and Kyle and all the rest of them got out of the deal.
So what's your sense, just in closing, Kate Gould, what is your sense of the talks, of course, in Baghdad were inconclusive, and even though the head of the IAEA, who had visited Tehran before the talks in Baghdad, had indicated a great deal of optimism, that has not proven to be borne out, and the talks have basically, they've agreed to keep talking in Moscow in a couple of weeks. What's your sense, though? You think that this is significant, what happened in the House, at least?
Certainly, and I think it's also significant what happened in Baghdad. The sides both committed to negotiations in spite of not actually having a clear agreement on these bigger issues. That's actually a bigger testament to their commitment than agreeing to something and then not agreeing to further talks. I mean, this is important, and the Obama administration should be applauded for turning diplomacy into a process rather than what Ambassador Pickering has previously called it, a series of one-night stands, as he's characterized U.S.-Iran talks before, and actually the Obama administration's approach to diplomacy with Iran, that it's only been this sort of one-off meeting and then rejection and, you know, from one side or the other, and then a refusal to go back. Well, this is actually, we're seeing an actual process where there's talks, and then a month later there's more talks, and this is positive. However, it's unfortunate that we're not seeing either side make the real concessions necessary here, and on the Obama administration side of things, that we're not seeing any willingness to budge on sanctions. That's what Iran can get from being involved with these talks. That that's what they're after, is to, and that's the U.S. leverage, is to lift sanctions. And Secretary Clinton just said that the Obama administration is not going to lift any sanctions. And those are very difficult for the administration to do by themselves because of this, you know, over 30 years of sanctions, most of them in the hands of Congress rather than the administration. So that they're really disempowered there. However, we have these European sanctions, the oil embargo that is supposed to go into effect on July 1st. And those, at the very least, that should be delayed. But instead, what we're seeing is that the only thing that they're offering in the way of sanctions relief is offering to send civilian aircraft parts. Well, that's nice, but the Obama administration should not be holding civilian aircraft parts. I mean, we're talking about the materials necessary for civilians to be able to have a safe flight and not die in the process, as 1,000 Iranians have, and 1,000 Iranian civilians have in the past decade. That should not be held hostage to these geopolitical concerns. So there's certainly a lot of room for improvement going forward.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Kate Gould.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Kate Gould, the Legislative Associate for Middle East Policy for the Friends Committee on National Legislation, a Quaker lobby in the public interest, fielding the largest team of registered peace lobbyists in Washington, D.C. She lobbies on Iran and Israel-Palestine peace and has a piece at Common Dreams, Congress Undeclares War with Iran. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking to the head of the Iranian desk at the National Security Council during the Bush administration.
Against humanity, while each for each and each world leader shed blood for what they each believe. On and on and on we go. Well, some will you see, some won't be true for you, and truth will lead you to a sense of heart. Oh, now.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Flint Leverett, who directs the Iran Project at the New America Foundation, where he's also a senior research fellow and teaches at Pennsylvania State University School of International Affairs. And from 1992 to 2003, he served as senior director for Middle East Affairs at the National Security Council, on the Secretary of State's policy planning staff, and as a CIA senior analyst. He left the George W. Bush administration and government service in 2003 because of disagreements about Middle East policy and the conduct of the war on terror. He is the author of Dealing with Tehran, Assessing U.S. Diplomatic Options Towards Iran. Welcome to Background Briefing, Flint Leverett.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be with you again.
And obviously the talks in Baghdad left with significant differences, quoting the EU foreign policy chief, and presumably that's why they've agreed to meet on June the 18th and 19th in Moscow. Missed signals, I guess, from the EU's Catherine Ashton, saying that the 2 days of talks in the Iraqi capital were intense. Both sides wanted to make progress, but significant differences remain. What do you read in the tea leaves there?
Well, I read a couple of things into it. On the American side, what I would read into it is that it seems the Obama administration is no more prepared to come to terms with the real issues you must deal with if you want an agreement with the Iranians on the nuclear question. The administration is no more prepared to deal with those questions, first of all, accepting internationally safeguarded enrichment in Iran, and secondly, providing meaningful sanctions relief as part of an overall deal. administration's no more prepared to deal with those things today than it was in 2009, the first time it went through an episode of nuclear diplomacy with Iran. And I think that while the administration clearly has an interest in avoiding a breakdown in the talks, I think they would at least like to keep the talks going through the November presidential election here in the United States. It doesn't seem like they're willing to pursue an agenda in the talks that might actually produce an agreement. And I think what's going on the Iranian side is that the Iranians are using the talks as a way of probing Western seriousness. They thought that perhaps because of higher oil prices, because of the threat that Israel might strike Iranian targets and drive up oil prices even further, because the sanctions that the U.S. and the EU are imposing are driving oil prices up even before they go into effect, that this might be an atmosphere in which the West, the Obama administration in particular, might be more serious about dealing with issues like safeguarded enrichment in Iran and sanctions relief than previously. And I think the Iranians are going to continue to use the talks, you know, as a way of exploring that. See if there is some flexibility, see if, you know, over time the administration adopts what from an Iranian perspective would be a more reasonable position. So I don't think either side is necessarily pushing you know, for a real showdown where if it doesn't get what it wants, it's going to walk out and the process breaks down. But if you look at the structural positions on both sides of the table, it's not a very optimistic picture in terms of getting to an agreement.
Well, Flint Leverett, how much is this to do with the election year and kicking the can down the road? Because on the one hand, the president has been, he threatened to veto the National Defense Authorization Act because he felt that it was tying his hands on Iran and mm-hmm. and would lead to rising gas prices in an election year. That's already happened, although the extent to which they've risen may have a lot to do with Wall Street manipulating the price up to 40%, some analysts say. But clearly, the other thing that constrains the president, I would assume, is that Mitt Romney is always already casting him as a kind of weakling and somebody that's all too ready to apologize for America. And that's why Obama can't do anything, make a deal with the Pakistanis to renew the supply of war material into Afghanistan. So if in any way Romney could seize on the idea that Obama was caving into Iran, wouldn't he make hay with that?
I'm sure he would, and I think you're right that that's an important element in the administration's calculation. The president's running for re-election, even though the polls show him in relatively good standing with the American people as a steward of foreign policy. The Republicans believe that this is the one issue on which Obama is potentially vulnerable, dealing with Iran. And I have no doubt that Mr. Romney and other Republicans will be following this very closely and try to exploit any opening that they think that the president and his administration have given them in the way that they handle Iran between now and November. That's absolutely true. But I think that there is there's also a kind of bigger strategic point that what the United States is doing, what it did in 2009 in negotiations with Iran, what it did was, and what it seems to be doing now, is basically to act like a dominant power, and a power that wants to secure its dominance over the Middle East by making this kind of independent upstart Iran come to heel on its terms. And I think that is, in the end, a dysfunctional position for the United States. It's not a strategic position. If you look at the way the balance of power is evolving in the Middle East, with the Arab Awakening, with other things that are going on in the region, with the basically the demise of the Arab-Israeli peace process, the United States is in relative terms a declining power in the Middle East. It needs to improve its relations with key states in the region, with a post-Mubarak Egypt, with a post-Saddam Iraq, with the Islamic Republic of Iran. It needs to do essentially what Nixon and Kissinger did vis-a-vis China in the early 1970s. But that requires a real strategic vision. It requires a real strategic commitment to redefining the way that the United States relates to an important part of the world. And I don't think for all that candidate Obama emphasized his willingness to engage Iran, that he came to the Oval Office with any real sense of what that meant, what it would take to succeed, or even really why the United States needed to engage Iran. And so he's never really staked out a vision for how to realign relations with the Islamic Republic. He's had policies that get made by committees with all kinds of interests, domestic and international, represented on them. And, you know, he's never been able to define a real negotiating posture. He couldn't do this in 2009 when, you know, he had very, very high poll ratings. He was starting off in an advantageous position like few new presidents have had. He really had some room to maneuver then, but he couldn't do it in that climate. Now he's trying to do it at the same time that he's running for re-election, and, you know, that's just going to constrain him all the more. But I think the fundamental problem is not domestic politics here in the United States so much as it is just a real lack of vision of what it is that we're trying to accomplish with Iran in these talks, or maybe I even say it's the wrong vision. We are trying to compel their surrender to our demands. We don't want them to have enrichment and so on. I don't think that's a winning hand for the United States. We need to come to terms with this country, like we did with China in the early 1970s. And Obama, in the end, he just doesn't have that vision. And the policy suffers as a result.
Again, I'm speaking with Flint Leverett, who from 1992 to 2003 served as Senior Director for Middle East Affairs at the National Security Council, on the Secretary of State's policy planning staff, and as a CIA senior analyst. He left the George W. Bush administration and government service in 2003 because of disagreements about Middle East policy and the conduct of the war on terror. Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head here, Flint Leverett. Surely the real issue is that there is, and you can't blame Obama for this entirely, he inherited a lot of this confusion. There seems to me to be utter confusion in our Middle East policy. Earlier in the program, we were just talking to an Egyptian sociologist in Cairo who was telling us about the enormous amounts of money the Saudis have been pouring into the Egyptian elections to try and influence the vote and change Egypt into more of a Saudi theocratic monarchy. Mm-hmm. And so we're supporting the Saudis, who have a cold war against the Iranians. And then on the other hand, the Bush administration installed a Shiite regime as friendly to Iran in Iraq. Yeah. And I guess at the end of the day, you have to ask yourself the question, who would we have been better off allying ourselves with, the Sunni kings or the Shia revival?
It's a really interesting and important question. You know, if you look at the things which American presidents have said have made us go to war in the Middle East over the last decade or so, it's been essentially a kind of jihadist terrorist threat, which is not just exclusively Sunni in origin, but it's kind of restricted to a particular strain of Sunni Islam, which is, in many respects, very close to Saudi Arabia. And not just close in an ideological or theological sense, but close in a financial sense. The Taliban would not exist without Saudi Arabia. In many ways, perversely, Al-Qaeda would not exist without Saudi Arabia. Every time the United States has wanted to take really strong action against al-Qaeda or the Taliban. The Islamic Republic of Iran has been prepared to work with us, to cooperate with us, to provide real material help in those efforts, because they see the Taliban and al-Qaeda as every bit as much their enemies as they are enemies of the United States. And it is a really interesting question that, you know, the allies that we pick in the Middle East, you know, end up in many ways being countries that also come with a lot of baggage and that end up, by virtue of their history, virtue of their policy choices, creating all kinds of new and serious problems for the United States. And in order to deal with these problems, we need to have a better relationship with this Islamic Republic of Iran. But that is a really daunting political challenge for any American administration.
So, Flint Leverett, we just prior to you were talking to legislative representative for the Quakers on Capitol Hill, and she was telling us about the undeclaration of war that John Conyers, Ron Paul, and Congressman Ellison and Walter Jones managed to get through the National Defense Authorization Act to literally undeclare war on Iran. Of course, she was quick to point out that the NDAA is largely ladled with weapons to have a war with Iran and
That's a lot
of belligerent language. Where do you think we stand on that issue? Because one of the things I think that the subtext here, I think, is that we mentioned earlier that the president is vulnerable to rising oil prices. He's obviously also vulnerable to the fact that Angela Merkel can't get her act together and the euro could crash and that would have a cascading effect over here.
Sure.
But where do we stand, do you think, in terms of the possibility of an Israeli strike on Iran before the elections?
I've tended to be skeptical that we would see a unilateral Israeli strike against Iran, for a number of reasons, but the most significant of which is that the options the Israelis have for striking Iranian targets on their own, in a military sense, they just aren't all that good. They aren't all that impressive. The number of planes they have that could operate at the ranges, their refueling capability, the kinds of ordnance that they would have to put onto some rather difficult targets like Natanz, where an enrichment facility is, or the new enrichment facility in Fordo outside of Qom. You know, when I've talked to people who have done this kind of planning for a living for the American military, you know, how would the American military go about trying to attack these kinds of targets, and they look at it and see what the Israelis have, what they could bring to bear, you know, it just doesn't seem like the Israelis could do a whole lot of damage. And I think that, in the end, that imposes a not trivial constraint on an Israeli decision to do this. You could risk creating all kinds of turmoil in oil markets, global economy, in the region, blowback against Israel from Hezbollah, from other quarters. And in the end, if you're not really very confident that you're going to accomplish very much, you know, how do you get to a point where you really, you know, are prepared to take that risk? I mean, it may still happen. I just don't think the odds are very high.
But do you give credence to
that? What the Israelis want to do is they want to maneuver the United States into a position where the United States would take on this mission itself, because the U.S. could deliver, you know, much, much more destructive power against Iranian targets. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, they can leverage, the Israelis can leverage the threat of a strike, you know, to get more sanctions out of the Europeans, out of the Americans, get more pressure on Iran. I mean, it's a useful thing in that sense for the Israelis to bring up. But I tend to think their long-term goal is really, I mean, to keep the pressure up on Iran from the international community and ultimately maneuver the United States into a position where it would be more likely to do it.
So do you give any credibility to reports that the Israelis have made arrangements to refuel their planes on the outer leg in the Kurdish north of Iraq and in Azerbaijan? which would make these airstrikes possible. However, my understanding is that at the end of the day, the only aerial platform that has the big bunker buster bomb that would be required to get to these underground facilities is the B-2 bomber, which the U.S. has alone.
I think that's right. I mean, I hear these stories about Azerbaijan or Kurdistan or even using, you know, kind of now abandoned former U.S. bases in Iraq south of Kurdistan. I don't really attach a lot of plausibility to those stories, but even if they were accurate, I mean, you still run up against this basic constraint that the bombs that the Israelis have to drop on, say, the Fordo, the new enrichment site, which is literally built into the side of a mountain. I mean, unless the Israelis were going to use nuclear weapons against Fordo, my understanding is they would be very, very hard put to destroy that target from the air. I mean, to, you know, take away the problems with refueling and all of that. Let's say they could stage out of Azerbaijan. They still just don't have the right bombs to drop on at least a couple of the targets.
So we're just in closing then. We're going to get through the election year without it, do you think? But after the elections, you think all bets could be off?
That tends to be my view. I think that the odds are, you know, the odds are better than not that we will get through the election without a unilateral Israeli strike. But I think that, you know, at that point, assuming that we haven't had diplomatic progress, that I think after the American election that Prime Minister Netanyahu will be back in Washington and he will be, you know, he will be exhorting either a reelected President Obama or a newly elected President Romney.
And one of his closest friends.
Indeed. But either way, I think he's going to be back and he's going to be, you know, making the case that now is the time for military action and not military action solely or even primarily by Israel, but with the United States in the lead.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Flint Leverett.
Thank you very much, Ian. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, too. Again, I've been speaking with Flint Leverett, who directs the Iran Project at the New America Foundation, where he's also a senior research fellow, and he also teaches at Pennsylvania State University School of International Affairs. And from 1992 to 2003, he served as a senior director for Middle East Affairs at the National Security Council, and he was also on the Secretary of State's policy planning staff, and he was a senior CIA analyst. He left the George W. Bush administration and government service in 2003 because of disagreements about Middle East policy and the conduct of the war on terror, and he's the author of Dealing with Tehran, Assessing U.S. Diplomatic Options Towards Iran. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Farhan Mohammed. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.